This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, there's a continuing issue in the Valley and in the country having to do with refugees, caravans, migrants, and associated issues. We had a show on this a few weeks ago, and we had three people on that show, a conflict resolution effort expert, a counterterrorism person, and a person who, Janie Dang, who's, was himself an actual one-time refugee. The story continues, and there's a different angle on this. Our first guest is Reverend Ken Heintzelman, and there's a headline in the press just the other day. ICE, the border enforcement folk, has dropped off 5,000 migrant family members at local churches. Well, he's one of the he represents one of those churches, and I think so. We can kind of pick up this story here and say, all right, some of these folks are coming to our community. And we're going to talk about what happens to them, what is their actual situation in the current situation, not with a past migrant, but in the current one. And later on, Marisol Anguelo is an immigration attorney, and we asked some legal questions last time, and I think some of us lay folks speculated on the answers that we'll get a little more definitive answer on some of the legal situations. When somebody approaches the border and says, for example, my family is being threatened by MI-13. I'm under fear of my life. Well, what actually happens at the border? And then if there's people either are admitted or not admitted at that time. I know it's also not whatever that if you're admitted, that's not a final decision. What happens and what's the process? And we're going to go through with that with her a little bit later. But Ken, I'd like to start out with you. First of all, where is your church physically located, and how did you get involved in this whole issue?
Well, our congregation is in North Central Phoenix, and we began
and your
immigration
denomination. Just so,
oh, is United Church of Christ?
Okay,
the same denomination as Barack Obama, who is not a Muslim, so it's the same denomination as him.
Okay,
so our church began immigration ministries about 4.5 years ago, mm-hmm. and we began by offering what's called sanctuary, part of the sanctuary movement in the 1980s.
I remember that.
And then sanctuary is when an attorney comes to our congregation and says, look, there's a legal or administrative remedy for this person. I just need time. I need time to navigate the system. And so then a person takes sanctuary in our congregation, and we stand with them. Our mission is to keep families together and to keep people safe. And
now, back in the 80s, that sanctuary meant that you were actually physically housing the people in the physical church. Is that still the case?
It is still the case. We're called the New Sanctuary Movement. It started in 2014. And we have had seven people over the last four and a half years. We've had seven people in sanctuary off and on, and we've been able to win some of those cases. Some of those cases were still pending, but they went off the campus, and then Immigration and Customs Enforcement Services, they grabbed them and deported them, even though there was a case pending.
So sanctuary meant a physical – essentially, there was a reluctance, if I'm reading between the lines, there's a reluctance of ICE to invade a church to grab somebody.
Yeah, that's right. There is a policy called sensitive location policy. And so ICE has this policy that they will not go into hospital, schools, or churches unless not to do so poses more of a danger to the community, and which I think makes a lot of sense.
Sure. So if somebody shows a violent tendency or something like that, then all bets are off.
Right. But those are not people that are going to be advocated for sanctuary by attorneys. And so, this is when people have a final order of deportation.
Okay.
And we're just needing more time to to make sure they can resume their lives.
Now, this is not the same group of people as I mean, this is a mental image that'd probably be shocking to a lot.
Yeah.
ICE arrives at your doorstep in a big old bus filled with migrants or refugees, right?
Yes, that's right. That's kind of where I was going.
And they're giving them to you.
Yes, that's right.
That's quite different from sanctuary.
Yes, that's right.
They're unloading. I'm reading between the lines. They're unloading a problem. They have to feed. If they're under ICE custody, they have to feed them, clothe them, house them. And they're dumping the problem on you.
Well, you're getting a taste of the irony, that we've experienced. So that our sanctuary guests, for example, are the people who are receiving the asylum seekers that ICE is delivering to our church. So the asylum seekers are getting off the bus, and ICE officers then go down the line with a clipboard, making sure that the people lined up match the people on the list. And then the very first thing that happens is our church members and the sanctuary people in sanctuary go and give them hugs and greet them, reassure them. They're traumatized, and so our sanctuary guests are the point people offering hospitality to the asylum seekers. And so they have this shared story of wanting a better life, wanting to be safe, wanting safety for their children. So they have these shared values, these shared stories.
Paint a picture for me. When did you take your first group?
Well, we started taking asylum seekers about 2.5 years ago. So this is why it's hit a lot of the news right now, especially the month before the election. This really has been going on for a long time, where ICE is receiving people at the border. They're processing them, and Marisol can speak more to the details of that. But when they're released from detention centers, they are then trying to reconnect with family in the United States, and we give them overnight hospitality.
I want to sort of get down in the weeds and paint the picture.
Okay.
You start doing this 2.5 years ago?
Yes.
How many arrived in the first batch?
Well, I mean, all of this goes all the way back to when all the news stories about the children are arriving, which was back in 2014.
I mean, in your church, how many got taken in the first instance?
Oh, we've had anywhere from 4 or 5 to 20. We had one time 72 in October.
At once?
At once.
Okay.
October 8th, we had 104.
Okay, that's a head count. How many come in at a time?
October 8th, there were 3 buses. It was 104 people.
Oh, my God.
That is unusual for us, but I believe there are churches in the East Valley that are getting that on a more regular basis.
Okay, I want to pick this up. We're going to return in just a minute, and I want to talk about, these folks come through the door. They get to your church. Okay, we mentioned hugs. Well, I want to know what comes next and what's the process and who's involved. And we'll return with Ken Heintzelman, Reverend, in just a moment. And later on, as I said, we have an immigration attorney with here. We'll pick up on other issues when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
All right. We're talking to Reverend Ken Heintzelman. He is involved with the church in Central Phoenix that has taken in refugees. Interestingly, surprising to many people, I think, more often than not, these folks are delivered to your doorstep by ICE.
Yeah. Well, I think that that is part of the irony. We're grateful. We're grateful to ICE that they are released from detention centers and that we're able to provide the hospitality. I mean, it's a gospel imperative, a mandate to love your neighbor. And so we provide food. We provide
that's what I was getting. They walk off the bus. They get a hug. What comes next?
They get hugs. They are welcomed. They are given food and showers. And we have a clothing closet where we are able to for them to get clean clothes, fresh clothes. Mm-hmm. We offer bedding. And, one of the things that happened, a story that sticks out in my mind, is one child, probably about 4 or 5 years old, Petra Falcone with Promise Arizona sat at a table in our dining hall and spoon-fed this child for 3 hours. The child was so traumatized. And by the next day, because children are so resilient, thank God, he couldn't take his eyes off the new shoes he had, you know, walking around looking at the floor and such. But so he went from this traumatized state where he was being spoon-fed to almost dancing because of his shoes.
Probably felt safe for the first time in a while.
Well, we tried to do that. We had one person from Guatemala. Apparently, a couple of months before he came through, we had a family member that came through, and he was at our church, and he said that his family member told him that if he made it to Phoenix and made it to Shadow Rock, that he would be safe. And so, you know, churches are facing decline here in the United States. I can't get people from across the street to come to my church, but people from Guatemala want to get in. So that's what it is.
So picture again. Are these folks generally camped out in your basement somewhere, or are you placing them with local families? What's next?
Well, we're also a church that hosts Family Promise. It's a program here in the Valley, and so we have equipment related to that. So we have a lot of inflatable beds, and we set up little tables, and we do all we can to make it feel and look as much like home, to at least to our standards, as we can. And we separate mothers with sons and fathers with daughters, and, you know, the men and the women, to provide as much privacy and safety as possible. We have people that that stay the night and keep eye on things. There's never been any issues, never been any problems, but they camp
out.
Any
neighborhood issues?
Well, there's some people always that disagree with the ministry and what it is that we're doing, and we do our best to listen to them and hear their concerns, and we invite them to come and take a look at the campus and take a look at the operation, so to hopefully ease their mind. But most of the people who are fearful or against it don't even want to consider it. So every once in a while, we'll get an email or a phone call, but it's very, very little.
Are your clients, are they out walking in the neighborhood, or are they kept pretty much within the confines of the church?
Oh, no, it's all kept within on the campus of the church. And
so if there's an objection, it's an objection to the idea of what you're doing, not based on actual incidents.
It's an objection to the idea, and usually based on fear or based on some kind of prejudice or bigotry.
So you have taken on successive waves of people. That means there must be an exit somewhere. Are people connecting with families or other, either their families or other families taking them in? Otherwise, you'd be an ever increasing population. Where are they going? Yeah. Where's the back door lead?
Well, what happens is that those families that come to us and receive one or two nights of hospitality, we then take them to the bus station. They get on a bus and they reconnect with family, some or a sponsor somewhere else in the country.
And there usually are those.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so when they get to that destination, then they have an ICE check-in appointment. And so they keep those appointments to the best of our knowledge.
So you're providing a warm space for a very short term.
Very short term when it's for asylum seekers. And the other thing that we're doing, quite honestly, is we're helping Immigration and Customs Enforcement people. We're helping them out, because otherwise they would be dumping scores of people at the bus station, creating temporary homeless issues for them.
I get this. They don't do hospitality well. Core mission.
They don't. It's not their core mission, and yet I think within Immigration and Customs Enforcement, it would be good to pick out 10 people from ICE randomly and listen to them speak about what their mission is, and to hear people of conscience within ICE to hear them talk about what they do well or what they don't do well.
You know, that's a great idea for a show. I don't know how comfortable individual line officers would be. But
I tell you, you get
below the policy level. Yeah. People who are actually dealing with people.
That's
would
right.
Be,
that's right.
That would be a fascinating.
One of the things that we've done at the church is on the 17th of every month for the last 3 years, it's only a few of us. We show up at ICE. We read a statement, say a prayer. And we hand out snacks and water to people waiting for appointments because we want to show a counter narrative of hospitality to those people. And we make sure that we say we are not demonizing the people that work in that building. We do feel the policies are unjust, and we do think that people of conscience from the inside are the best ways to reform it.
Mm-hmm. And your experience generally has been positive with them?
No.
No.
Okay, no, but okay. We remain positive.
I see.
But no, our experience in general has not been positive, especially since the latest administration. We have seen that negotiating and conversation and communication has gone to absolutely zero. And
yet they're the same people.
And yet they're the same people. That's right.
All right.
And what our experience really has been is that they've lied to us. They've lied to us in order to isolate vulnerable people so as to detain them and deport them. They've lied to us.
In what way? Real quickly, but on what? How?
Well, for example, at the beginning, I think attorneys have wised up. At the beginning, it was, come on in for the check-in appointment. It's not a problem. You've done this many times. Huh. And then we directly ask, do you plan to detain or deport? They say, no.
Nice. Gotcha. Okay, we're out of time for this segment. We will be back, and we'll bring Marisol Angulo, who is an immigration attorney, into the show when we return to Think Tank in just a moment.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
All right, we've been talking immigration and refugees. Now, there's a legal aspect of that. I mean, it's fundamentally a legal issue. Marisol Angulo is an immigration attorney. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
You've been here listening. Okay, I want to, again, paint a picture, okay? Somebody arrives at the border and says something like, MI-13 says they're going to kill my family if my teenage son doesn't, or something like that, where the story would qualify for refugee status if true and if provable. Somebody makes a statement like that. In other words, they're not just saying, I'm here for a job, I want to earn more money. That doesn't qualify you as refugee. But the question is, you're at the border, you make a statement like that. Typically, what happens?
So it's what it's called is a claim or a fear of return. And so when a person makes a claim of fear of return before an immigration officer, that sets a series of events that's supposed to happen once somebody makes a fear of return. How that person makes that fear of return is sometimes it's too... It can happen one of two ways. The first way is they can try to turn themselves in at the border, as you were describing. The issue with that recently is that they're not allowing people to turn themselves in. And so what it creates is this situation where you have people that are trying to turn themselves in and they're not being allowed to, which forces them then to try to enter the United States.
Let me understand this, and I cross the border all the time in Lukeville. If somebody they're walking up to the border and they're being physically prevented from crossing.
So what's going on right now in San Ysidro is that they're walking up to the station and they're not being allowed to make their claim.
Okay.
And so
basically being obstructed from crossing
and
the border.
So that's where you have this problem with people camping out, because in San Ysidro, what it's being reported is only a certain amount of people are being allowed per day. And it has reduced some days to two people per day that are being allowed to turn themselves
in. So if you've got hundreds or thousands waiting and you're allowing two people per day, you're basically... It's a policy to discourage people from coming.
And you're at a border such as San Ysidro, where it's a huge border. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can look locally, San Luis, Arizona. We had an influx of Brazilians that were camping out as well, because, again, they're trying to turn themselves in to make this fear of return claim. And so what happens is, when people aren't allowed to turn themselves in, they try to provoke the situation by trying to cross. In Texas, for example, they have the bridge. And so if they weren't allowed to turn themselves in over the bridge, they were trying to cross through the river, being detained.
If I understand, is the difference whether you put your feet on American soil? If you put your feet on American soil, you can make that claim. If you're prevented from... if you're kept 2 feet on the other side, are these people who've actually crossed the border by a little?
The issue is them being able to present themselves to an immigration officer to make their claim of fear.
Okay.
So once a person actually is able to get to that point to make the fear,
yeah,
if they were allowed to turn themselves in, they're processed. If they come in with their family, mm-hmm, they're fingerprinted, they're interviewed, and they are, the officer at that point has to make a decision if this person is a danger to the community, if this person is coming in with families.
Right.
Again,
this officer is an individual ICE officer?
It's the CBP, Customs and Border Patrol.
Okay.
And they're... you know, their officers and their supervisors. I'm
getting at what kind of person is this? I mean, the ICE people, they're basically, they're cops, or
they're processing the
people,
right? And then so the okay, next stage is getting to an asylum officer to have their credible fear interview.
But the first person they encounter gets to make a decision that they can send them back.
No, they make a decision as to whether that person's going to be released on parole, as some people that are being turned in over to the churches, or if that person is being determined to be a danger, or they have, for some reason, a security risk.
Okay.
And then they're detained.
I assume you could do some sort of a check, fingerprint check or something
they
like
have
that.
The capabilities to do that,
if they have
a
criminal record, maybe you say no. But,
correct.
But let's say... either the record comes up clean or they can't find anything. How could somebody be determined to be a danger? What would make somebody be classified?
Well, I think they probably
subjective?
They have a checklist of things. You know, they try to figure out if they have family, as Pastor Ken mentioned. Are they traveling with their family? Are they traveling individual? So there's a series of balances that they have mm-hmm. to assess in order to determine if they're going to let them be released on their own recognizance pending their asylum process.
And that is a decision made by who at what level?
At the border.
At the border by the first agent they come in contact with?
I don't think the agent per se. I believe it's probably the whole office.
Okay.
It goes up through the chain.
And they,
at certain points, somebody says, these people can be released on parole. And that's how you end up with buses full of families.
Okay. One choice is you're released on parole, so you might end up at Ken's church.
Uh-huh. Pending your asylum process. Not being detained.
Choice number two is you're incarcerated at the border?
They detain them.
Okay.
They process them, and they transfer them to a detention center facility based on bed space.
Okay. Is there a third option? No, we're just turning you away? Is that also an option? Or no?
Once a person makes a claim of credible fear, legally, they are supposed to be allowed to at least speak to an asylum officer about their claim.
Okay, so you're going to either end up in Ken's church or some equivalent, or you're going to end up in some custodial situation. You're not going to be sent back without some further hearing.
Correct. That's the way asylum works. And if a person's been here before, sometimes it's not considered a credible fear interview. Credible fear is specific to a person that's being encountered for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
A person that has been here before and let's say somebody was returned to their country, and then once they were returned to their country, something happened and now they're presenting themselves. That person would go through what's called a reasonable fear interview. So there's a heightened standard of fear that that person must establish.
Reasonable is higher than credible.
Yes. Okay. Right. In legal terms, in terms of the evidence to demonstrate is higher.
Reasonable. Sounds sort of like probable cause level.
It's legal terms, yeah.
I mean, probable cause is something short of absolute proof, but it's more than fanciful notions.
So credible fear is basically an asylum officer who's trained in being able to interview, being able to basically say not only establish not only that this person has a fear, but that that fear is tied to one of the groups of people or that this country protects. For example, that person is being persecuted in their home country because they had political affiliations. And as a country, we protect free speech. And
we used to be, and maybe even still is, if you're a Cuban, you had carte blanche. You were presumed to be.
So
we have this anti-communist thing if you came from a communist country.
So that's one of the biggest complications about asylum law is people think that, oh, these people are just coming to get asylum, but the reality is that more than likely these asylum cases are very, very difficult. Prior Attorney General Jeff Sessions reserved a lot of legal decisions to himself before he resigned, rewriting asylum law, so making it more difficult for people to be able to establish claims. And so it's not just the fact that the person is presenting themselves saying they have a fear of return, but it's also being able to demonstrate that that fear, there's a connection between that fear and one of the protected grounds this country protects.
Okay, very specific question. And this is what people are very concerned about this. A lot of them will say, well, these folks are being couched in what to say, and they're being told the magic word. So somebody comes in and they present a picture of, you know, the example I gave, my MI-13 is rampant in my neighborhood, and my teenager got told he's going to join the game or else a gang or we'll kill your whole family. My guess is that if that were proven, that would be likely a successful case. But how do you know, what's the standard of proof for that in the sense that somebody can say that? I can't imagine that, you know, if you don't have tape recordings or documents, or how does one determine a case like that where it is legitimate fear on the one hand from the possibility that it's simply a made up thing where somebody simply wants to get a better economic life?
What kind
of documentation is there?
In either scenario that you presented, it's extremely hard to prevail in asylum, mm-hmm. as I stated, because asylum requires not only that you say and present your fear, but to be able to associate or connect that to one of the protective grounds this country protects. Mm-hmm. And so just showing up and saying, a body ran down the hill in front of my house, and now the MS-13 thinks that I'm gonna report them, and now they've been extorting money from me so that to keep my safety. That case is still not an easy case to win, even in the scenario where it's true, because again, we have to prove that that fear, that's well-founded fear, that it's a credible fear, is connected to one of the grounds this country is going to protect.
Among other things, that you have to have more going for you than just the story that somebody has orally.
It not only has to be a story that you can prove, but it also has to be a situation where the government is in a political position to protect that reason of persecution that you're fleeing for.
We'll be back in a final segment in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Marisol Angulo is an immigration attorney. We've been talking immigration, refugee status. Tell me some idea the kind of numbers we're talking about. How many folks are coming through the border on refugee status, and how many of them are getting successfully adjudicated?
Well, I will tell you that people turning themselves into the border has been happening for years. There has been an increase of judges due to especially this administration's executive orders wanting these asylum seekers to be processed quickly. Mm-hmm. I would say ballparking, the numbers are in the thousands of people that are probably trying to turn themselves in. I can tell you it probably varies based on the border that they're trying to access. You know, obviously San Ysidro is a huge port of entry.
That's basically Tijuana, San Diego.
Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we are a border state. So we have other port of entries where we've seen other immigrants try to get paroled in, not only Central American, but we had Brazilians for a while in the Yuma area.
Well, you made an interesting point during the break, and I wanted you to explain that as well. People are treated really quite differently if they come through the legal border or if they hop the fence. They're really putting themselves in a completely different class.
Right? So what I was explaining in the beginning is that credible fear has to be made to an officer. Mm-hmm. And if a person tries to enter, meaning I want to be allowed, paroled in to present my asylum claim, mm-hmm. they're going to be processed. But when that person doesn't have access to enter through the legal channels that are established
by
for an asylum,
yourself at the border.
By presenting yourself, what was happening, at least in Texas, is where there's a bridge. And so if you were able to go over the bridge, that means you were able to allow yourself to turn yourself into Border Patrol agents. But when they weren't allowing you to turn yourself in, people were just getting anxious because they have fears. They've never been in that port of entry. Mm-hmm. And so they were going under the bridge through the river, the Rio Grande. Mm-hmm. And so once a person gets caught trying to enter, then that person is processed differently than a person who just is allowed to turn themselves in and make their claim. Once a person is detained trying to enter the United States illegally, then at that point, that person now has access to that officer to make the claim of credible fear, but they're treated differently because when you try to enter the United States, now you're seen as a risk to the community, a danger.
So you sit at the border, you wait your turn, you discover you're in a line that never moves. You try to swim across the river and basically, now you're classified as dangerous because you entered illegally.
Exactly.
I think they called that Catch-22 once upon a time.
That is the image that you see on the TV of people trying to enter, not because they want to force their way in. It's because they're only allowing five people and there's thousands of people waiting in line for a process that has been historically established to allow them to make their claims of fear.
And the five people a day, that's due to change in policy, right?
Currently, that's the crisis that you're seeing, not because more people are suddenly going to the border. It's just they are not being able to have access.
There are not more people approaching the border. It's just more of a backlog because they're not letting them through.
I think it's the fact that they're not allowing themselves to turn themselves in to go through this process.
So to the person who says, well, why don't they do it the right way, you say?
And I will say the right way also means that the vast majority of these asylum seekers that are able to get through, whether it's through bond or paroled in, most of these people end up losing their claims.
Ballpark a percent of these
claims
are successful.
Above 90%, between 90 and 95% of people that have valid claims lose their asylum cases because, again, it's not just about having the fear. I interview families all the time that have gone through rapes, murder, extortion, and they lose their claims every day, not because the government doesn't believe what has happened to them, but because they don't fall within one of the categories that this government...
What are the categories?
Well, there's different categories that the government protects. For example, they will protect somebody who is being discriminated based on their gender. Mm-hmm. They will protect somebody who's being discriminated based on their political opinion.
Religion, I think, is another
religion.
One.
Religion. Mm-hmm. And so those are the established groups of people or groups of asylum or persecutions that this country tries to protect. And then you have this whole catch-all fifth category, which is people that fall into this political social group or particular social group. What a particular social group varies based on what state you're in, what circuit and what circuit your state belongs to, what judge you ultimately are assigned to present yourself before. And you're talking about people that have mostly never been to the United States, don't know what an ankle monitor is, don't know what bond means, don't know what parole means, don't know that, oh, I have to at some point sit and tell my story again about how I was victimized and victimized and how my son was kidnapped because his build just matched a good size for a gang member and they wanted to forcefully take him for the gangs. And they're going through real things that, you know, you couldn't imagine. You couldn't imagine. And I invite any person that really wants to know about what is going on in these countries that people are trying to flee. People don't flee because they want to. People don't, you don't buy a house and build a house and spend all this money building a house just to leave it for no reason. People are leaving because they are trying to live. They are being persecuted by lawlessness. They're being persecuted by members of gangs that permeate their countries. They are starving. They are just trying to eat, find food. They're trying to just have peace. And all of these people are equally vetted to be released. So I don't understand where this whole they're dangerous because they're vetted. Once they're allowed to present themselves, they're vetted individually. And we have a whole system in place for dangerous people, especially for immigration purposes.
And to somebody who says, oh, these folks are just want to come here for better economic life and we can't take everybody in the world who wants to do that, you say?
And we're not taking them. 95% are losing their claims, even if they can establish they have a fear.
Ken, I'll give you a moment. If you want a contact information, anybody would like to connect with you, how would they do that?
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the role of media to dispel the false narrative. I want to add to what Mariso says, and that is the first premise.
We've got like 15, 20 seconds. Saying, okay.
Is migration is a natural human phenomenon. People move when they're desperate. And we need to figure out how to open our hearts in the most abundant nation in the world.
You want a phone number or anything like that?
No.
Okay. As you wish. Okay. I'm sure we will return to the subject as long as there's folks at the border and media covering it. I'm sure we'll be back on the subject again in the think tank. We'll see you next week.